Hello and welcome to this episode of Better Off Red. My name's Pip Adam and this is episode 129 of the podcast, and it's episode 16 of our Beyond a Joke series. I keep saying owl, it's just me, I'm here by myself. I guess the guests are the owl, the team that helps me, well, without whom I could not make this podcast. So yeah, this is Beyond a Joke episode 16. This is going well, do you think? Anyway, in this episode I get to talk to Murdoch Stevens. We sort of use a photo of an oil sign that he took while away as a way into talking about Murdoch's work. Murdoch has written a lot over the years, but what we focus on a little bit in this interview is the Renters United edition of Rat King Landlord, which Murdoch is just back in Wellington from touring around New Zealand, as well as launching the book. He's also been speaking with members of Renters United about their plans to improve renters' rights in Aotearoa, New Zealand. I have a giveaway. I have a bundle, which is the Rented United's edition of Rat King Landlord. It's also the original edition of Rat King Landlord and a copy of Murdoch's new novel, Down from Upland. So if you would like to enter that, if you just, direct message me on Twitter or reply to our Instagram story or leave a message after, leave a comment on the newsletter, I will put everybody into the draw and I will make sure that is drawn soon. I really enjoyed talking to Murdoch and I hope you enjoy this episode, and yeah, thanks heaps for listening. Hi Murdoch, how are you?
Hi Pip, I am very well.
That's nice. It's very dark. It's only like outside. 5 p.m.
Yeah, well, when is the shortest day? Tomorrow or the next day?
That soon?
Yeah, 20th, 21st, I think.
That makes me feel better because I was starting to feel a bit like, is the sun never coming back? But yeah, it's been very nice. So it's really lovely to have you here. I'm extremely grateful to have you here. And I wonder if we could start with you introducing yourself, however you want to introduce yourself.
Okay, kia ora koutou, folks. My name is Murdoch Stevens. I am an author and a founding member of Lawrence and Gibson Publishing Collective. That is a collective of, I don't know, roughly like six people sort of, based in Pōneke, Wellington, putting out weird and wonderful books for the last 17 years. 17 years, I think, 17, 18 almost. I wrote a number of books under a pen name called Richard Meros many years ago. And then I sort of got serious about the world, a bit more serious, and did this campaign to double New Zealand's refugee quota, which is actually like tomorrow the government's going to announce, hey, we got to the 1,500, we got to the doubled quota. But that made me a bit more serious and change a little bit and maybe be less bashful about putting my name out into the world. So then in 2020, I released a novel called Rat King Landlord, and then last year, Down from Upland. Yeah, man. That's me.
Oh, thank you so much, Murdoch. And I guess we can't let the occasion pass without you. Lawrence and Gibson launched two new books last week, eh?
Yeah, we did. Had a launch at Unity Books, that bastion of literature. We released Thomas and Slay's third book with us, The Words for Her. And we released T. Hema Baker's first book with us, but his sort of fourth book in the scheme of things, called Turncoat.
Yeah.
And they're both brilliant and causing a lot of work for the collective right now, which we love and hate in equal measures. We want to be writing our own books, not distributing yours.
This is the killer about collectives, eh?
Yeah.
It's just so wonderful to be supporting everybody.
Like when Brenovan sold like almost 2,000 copies of Spriggs and was shortlisted for the Ockhams. You imagine the amount of work that the collective had to do. Brenovan.
Come on.
Write something terrible next.
Don't write so good, Brenovan. What are you doing? Oh my gosh, it's so weird. Now, you have agreed and have done so. You've brought along an object that has made you laugh. And I have it up on the screen now, and no one can see that. It's radio. Sorry. But I just wonder, do you want to describe the object?
Yeah, I'll give a bit of background. So I've travelled a bunch in my life, and I like travelling slowly overland and going through all sorts of different countries. And I like collecting weird bits of detritus or anything that I find humorous or strange out of this world. Like, there's this one disinfectant poster I found in Tirana, I think, in Albania. And it's just got these little pictures, this little clip art thing. But also just the language there is kind of, it looks cool on a poster. And maybe if I found that at home, it wouldn't be so awesome. But when you're overseas, it's kind of these funny little things that you collect up in your little satchel and take home. So one of the funniest last time, well, one of just the oddest and interesting is there's a petrol station in Albania called Castrati, which sounds a lot like castration.
Yeah.
And I love the idea that there's a gas station named after castration in some sort of parallel universe, like some like second wave feminist universe that is completely taken over and all the men are in these death camps or re-education camps. And the notion of castrating men was so elevated that you would have a gas station. Well, elevated but banal, right? But then the thing I love beside it as well is it's a gas station and its logo isn't like some happy smiling guy or anything. It is like a bejeweled goat's head on top of this gem encrusted like ornamental container. And so it's the kind of thing you want when you're traveling around the world. You don't just want everything to look the same. You want something to be just completely whack and out of this world. So the Castrati petrol station name and logo were ones that made me laugh, and also repeatedly because I traveled around the country for like a week or two.
And I'm very excited that 96 octane is 185 units of, I don't know, but yeah. And I like the way octane spelled octane in that language. Like it feels like that translates beautifully in all languages, octane.
Octane. Yeah. There's something beautiful about other languages that like they're similar to English, but mock it.
Yeah.
Maybe English is similar to it, and we are the little magpies of language.
Yeah, and it's such a beautiful photo. Like, as well as being quite odd in it, because I instantly thought of Castrata arias, and was thinking of, and like, it just feels so elevated for petrol. And in reality, I mean, you know, petrol, you know, I mean, it kind of did this weird throwback into where I live and where petrol sort of feels ubiquitous, but really it's like one of these, like it's kind of like, it's sort of the bones of dinosaurs. Like it's kind of this very amazing thing, but here we call it Shell or, you know, like, I don't know. It's really beautiful. And I really love the flags and the sky looks amazing as well. Gosh.
Yeah. My friend and I kept trying to find little, there is a Castrati flag that we were pretty tempted to, if we found one, just sneak in and steal. Or maybe like an air freshener. We saw one car with a Castrati air freshener inside, but we couldn't find any merch at all. There were jumpsuits that the guys working the petrol station had. Like if you had a Castrati, and this is like a sort of, I grew up in Otago and it's the rugby colours of Otago, blue and gold. That would go down a treat, I reckon, on Cuba Street. Don't you think, Pip?
I want one.
Castrati jumpsuit?
I want a Castrati jumpsuit. I think we should maybe talk to someone about that quickly. No, it's brilliant. I really, really love it. I really love it. And I think like you've talked a little bit about what is humorous. It's sort of like that, that kind of mismatch of, like, I don't know, like there's something so great. I think the thing that I like the most about it is the logo. Like the logo just feels so like mystical or kind of like
it's almost death metal.
Yeah, it feels very death metal. The goat has horns. So do you think it's a goat? I think it's a goat.
Yeah, I think I'd say a goat.
Yeah, I really. And then it's got this really interesting shape that almost looks like HH, which made me think of Herman Hesse for some reason. I don't know. Like, yeah, I really like it because it does feel that great disorientation that happens when you're traveling, you become someone else and your brain becomes someone else and dream logic takes over or something amazing like that. It's really incredible. I remember the days of Richard Meros where I remember going to a party once where you were and someone said, Richard Meros is here. And I was like, really? Oh my gosh. But those, I mean, I feel like humour has a place in your work, but I don't know, do you, like, yeah, I wonder, do you want to talk a little bit about the place of humour in your work?
Yeah, I mean, it's a hard thing to talk about. In the publishing collective, we've kind of got a running approach, which is never market anything as humorous or as funny or as comedy, because you're setting yourself up to fail. It's really easy. You say, oh, this is a really funny book. And if people don't laugh, then they're... I mean, and maybe humor's just so multifarious that what I find funny, you know, like those first books that I did were... the first public reading I did of the Richard Meiros book was in the old Anarchist Freedom Shop in like 2005 out the back some night. And I was so deflated after reading it. And I had this off-the-cuff comment at the end of reading a page. I was like, oh, I guess I realized that I think this is funny, but actually it's just the whole concept is a bit of a laugh. It's not jokes funny. It's conceptually a bit weird, and the idea that this exists is the joke. And maybe that's the thread through a lot of my work. And I don't know where that comes from, but there's sort of something where if you can... And maybe there's some dissatisfaction with the world as it stands, both politically and, you know, what it could be and all that. But if you can create an equally absurd world, maybe, I don't know. Yeah, there's some sort of joy in mocking at that level. But I don't know. It's funny because when my first book, On the Conditions and Possibilities of Helen Clark Taking Me as Her Young Lover, came out, like, people thought that was a... ha-ha, Dixon, breast jokes. And there was none of that in there. It was supposed to be sort of a joke that this book would exist in the world, that this weird artifact would exist, and the ha was supposed to be when someone found it in a secondhand bookstore 15 years down the track. But then when actually some of the jokes in the book were performed on stage by Arthur Meek and the sort of travelling production, people were laughing in the audience, and they weren't titillated. They were just kind of like, yeah, they were humorified. And that sort of made me think, well, I guess I don't get to watch people reading my books. I don't really laugh aloud that much when I'm reading other people's ones, but maybe people do laugh. So anyway, it's pretty hard to understand in a way how humor works there, because there must be some intent, right? There must be something... If you're doing things that are considered satire or whatever, but I don't intend to be funny. Yeah, so maybe I'm just confused.
No, I think it's that's the thing. Like, I feel like comedy is one of the most unforgiving art forms, because like if the laugh is not there, we consider it a failure. But I think sometimes a laugh is not the point of humour, if you know what I mean. Like, I think sometimes a sense of dis-ease or maybe a like a lift or a change or that sense of the uncanny is often also in sort of intrinsic in comedy as well. And like, and this is why I wonder if it is quite good. Like, I wonder how you feel about whether it has a political purpose. Like, you use that word absurd, and I kind of, it's something that I look up to almost more than anything, is sort of that idea of the absurd, that either, we supersize a situation or we bring a situation into the ridiculous, and you know, like all of a sudden that kind of reflects back on our thing. But I just wonder, do you think humour and the absurd has political potential, I guess is what I'm saying? Or do you think it's just one of the modes that we perform political, you know, like politics?
Yeah, hard to know. Like, I guess some of it is like, what is political potential there? We certainly can talk about political things and we can ridicule, but whether that leads to any measurable or quantifiable change. And that's kind of the important part of politics, right, is winning. Not to be rude or nothing about it, but like, if you're doing politics and you're constantly losing and you start, are loving that losing, then you're not doing it right. So for me, when it's quite a high bar to say that humour would have a political, like there can be political entertainment. There's a whole, we live in Wellington, right? Everyone loves just consuming political things and feeling political. So I guess I consider them all quite high bars. What can it do? Like, you know, people often want to make the argument, it's sort of like a writer's festival thing where they want to say the political power of literature or of humour, and I'm maybe just a bit reluctant to accept that because it feels like an easy thing to put out there. But as you were talking before, it made me think, oh, well, maybe there is something about mocking an institution. But I'm probably only thinking there's probably only very small points in time where that is part of a broader political movement or the organisation. You know, people always think of the sort of mocking the emperor with no clothes or something like that, or pointing out this stuff as if you can use humour to expose the corruption in the world. But it feels like the world is completely overexposed at the moment, and there's constant exposure and people can just buffoon along without it really affecting them. They're sort of protected against any critique.
Because I was sort of thinking that there seems to be a real deficit of shame in anybody as well. You know, like I was listening to Luxon the other day and like they're just, do you know what I mean? Like it feels like ridiculing someone like that is not going to change anything because he doesn't care.
Yeah. I mean, we learn, right? We learn in political spaces what the people opposing us will do, and maybe sometimes their views of what is functional and successful in terms of activism and, you know, political art is maybe from 30 or 40 years ago. It doesn't function in the digital age where there's just so much information and so many people slagging people off in a public space. So yeah, I'm not really, like, I don't see my work in particular as I don't know, some heroic attempt to insert myself into the political landscape. It's, I think it's more of that absurdity that I find creating these other worlds to be amusing and entertaining. I don't know.
I really like that. I one of my favourite writers, she's a Korean writer, and someone asked her what can writing do politically, and she said writing can do nothing. You know, like we need to be on the streets, we need to be shouting, we need to be, like, that's where the political action needs to be. The writing is something else, which I really appreciated.
Yeah, it's kind of, it's pretty individualistic, right? Like you're writing a book and it's very satisfying for all sorts of levels, but the idea, I guess people have that hero fantasy of I can do the George Orwell and I don't even know what George Orwell did, to be honest, but, you know, that it's going to topple governments. It's such like a young man's, like, you know, like dream what the solitudinous artist is. But yeah, just like she said, fucking organize. You got to be involved if you want to change something. And, you know, and maybe humor's got a place there. Like maybe humor has that place of forging friendship and solidarity. If you can joke with someone interpersonally, then they might start to trust you. They might see you as a friend and you continue to do that. So humor does have that place, but I'm not sure if it's in the kind of grand expose power way, but more building connections and trust and I don't know, a sense of humanness.
Because I really love that. Like I often think that is one thing that a book can do is build community. You know, like if I think about the books that have been important to me, they've made me sort of like this sounds very selfish as well, but they've made me realise who I am and what I believe in, and, you know, that has led me to other people that like that book. And do you know what I mean? Like there can be sort of an organiser, and the amazing work that you do at Lawrence and Gibson. Like, I mean, the other night at Unity just felt like such a beautiful, and you talked about solidarity, but it felt like such an incredibly poignant, I know it was a celebration and there was food and drink and everything, but it felt hopeful. Like when I left, I felt hopeful. Like, yeah.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. I thought it wasn't, like, I remember my last two launches and I was funny as hell. Like a couple of friends from overseas, like former refugees, were there and they're like, Moordog, we did not know that you were funny, but you're a very funny man. I don't know if we're allowed to. The only accents we're allowed to do anymore, it's South African, right? And Russian.
I think so.
Yeah, possibly. So I shouldn't be doing my Persian friends. But they're so good. Yeah, this was not a funny launch at all, I thought. But it was a lovely time.
Yeah, it was a really, really great time. And I think that, I don't know, and that sort of leads me into some of the other work that you've been doing recently. There is this new edition, the Renters United edition of Rat King Landlord. And I wonder, if we could just step back a little bit from it and just talk about the premise of that book, because it's got this thing I love about it, because I was just rereading, this edition for the interview, and the thing is that it's absurd, but it's completely not absurd, if you know what I mean. It's got this wonderful, it feels real. It's like the lie that tells the truth kind of thing. And I just wonder, can you remember where the spark of it came? Can you remember, I know I really love asking people where their ideas come from, and I know you're not supposed to, but I just wonder, how do you get from, how do you get to the rat as the landlord?
I guess it's the intersection of anger and needing to break that anger with something funny. Mm, mm. So we were in our flat in Mount Victoria in 2019, and the landlord was putting the rent up 19% because they can, and they were using a property management company to do that because they can for whatever reason, whatever. And so we, as good middle-class Wellingtonians, thought, if we could just talk to the landlord, we could reasoneth with them. But we couldn't find out who owned the house, and we searched underneath the house and all these, if you're a landlord, you own the place, you got a bunch of your old crap that's downstairs that you left there because you couldn't be bothered to move it. We sort of found a few names, but none of it really matched up. And so we couldn't even find who owned it, and we asked the property management company if they would mind talking to them about it and letting us talk to the landlord, and they just ignored that email. And so we're in the kitchen one night thinking, well, what do we do next? We've got to put our rent up in 3 weeks, 19%. How are we going to divide that up? Can we still talk to the landlord? Who is the landlord? What's going on? And then we also at the same time had this problem of the rat in a compost bin. We're like, no one is telling us that it's not the rat. Has anyone asked the rat? Is the rat the landlord? I don't know. Should we go out and, tip those scraps in, but maybe do it quite kindly? Because if they're the landlord, we probably want to be a bit gentle with them, because we've got this whole 19% problem. So we ended up just joking around, myself and a flatmate, for half an hour about what a house would be like if a rat was a landlord.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's kind of the genesis of it. And then just kept kicking it around as a concept. Yeah, and then it was a book. Mm. Voila.
Because you do – that's quite a difficult task to set yourself. You know what I mean? I find the book, moving and funny and ironic and, it is quite amazing, those moments where it does feel – it hits the heart, it does feel what the fuck is going on with housing? I definitely had moments like that. And I just wonder, I don't know, I really don't know how to ask this question, but I'm just wondering, having set yourself that task, how did you solve the problems of having, this, did you, you talked before about creating these worlds, and I'm wondering, is it about creating a world where this can happen, or is this convincing us that it's happening in this world? Or, I just wonder about how you solve those problems of bringing the reader along with you, I guess.
Yeah, I think it's iterations and editing. Mm. So it actually reminds me a lot of the whole On the Conditions and Possibilities of Helen Clark Taking Me as Her Young Lover was basically saying, here's an absurd goal at the end. Let's walk it back every step. What would actually have to happen for this very unlikely event to take place? And it was sort of like that with the rat as the landlord. We're like, okay, let's assume the rat is the landlord. So what does it want? How did it get there? How's it communicating with us? So, it kind of set myself this distant goal to get to. And that's why it was kind of also with, there's so much technology around and so much interesting stuff about us understanding the sentience of animals now.
Mm, mm.
And I I guess for a long time I've valued the sentience of animals in the sense that I think it's ridiculous the way that we kill and eat them. Like, it feels crazy barbaric and is pretty shameful for myself. And I mean, I don't do that anymore, but like, I find it like really like, yeah, terrifying. Yeah, so trying to work out, okay, so if we understand this, what would the sentient little rat do? And then it was kind of fun just to play around with ideas of, oh, well, they'd probably use a smartphone in some way to communicate. And, you know, we've got this concept of the post-literate now, people who can read books but choose not to, or can read. And I sort of feel like there's technologies there that have developed so far that the book is actually the antiquated thing and writing's the antiquated thing. You know, the rat could leave little voicey messages if it could speak. Yeah.
I really love this idea of starting with this goal and kind of stepping back. Like, that just seems like such a great, I don't know, I really love that idea. It's like, okay, so what would need to happen to get us to there, and what would need to happen to get us there? I really, really like that idea. This new edition that you've put together has illustrations as well, and I just wonder about, like, before we get to, like, the purpose of it, I know, why don't we start there? Like, what made you want to revisit it in this format? Like, there's a really nice forward in it that talks about, you know, like, how you got there. But I just wonder if you could maybe talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I was pretty immediately afterwards first releasing it that I went out to Renters United and wanted to talk to them about what it would look like to collaborate on a really cheap version of it. It sort of got kicked around for a while. They had their other projects. I had my own ones. I mean, in a purely selfish way, the idea that we'd be able to get it out to way more people. And Lawrence and Gibson's a not-for-profit publishing collective. We don't care about money, so it's really about getting it in people's hands. And the idea that I could collaborate with a group of people who I knew shared the same values as me and that really loved this book, and then could use it to get out to a whole bunch of other people who really love it. Because that's sort of the challenge of being a writer. You know, sometimes I think back in my Miros days, I walked down Willis Street one time and counted 100 people. And maybe it was my own prejudice. I just sort of looked at them in central Wellington, like a pretty good readery space, and thought, would any of these people be interested in my book? And I think there was like one person. I was like, oh, that person might be. And maybe it was full of prejudice in that. But there's sort of a sense that there's an audience out there. Audience exists. It's just a question of how do you get in front of them and steal some of their precious time for your own little vanity things? I mean, at the same time, Renters United's awesome, and I'm so impressed with the way that they just get so much media attention, and they've got the guts to do that, to go on live television every other week and just rip into this messed up market. Whereas a lot of us who are renters, it's a pretty scary thing. You don't, you know, I'm sort of imagining next time I apply to get a flat. I just hope they don't Google me too much, or that they have a sense of humor, or maybe they see it as something they can brag to their like left wing middle class Wellington property investor mates about. I don't know. So it's, yeah, I wanted to get it out because of them. I revisited it because they had time now. And, you know, it's not just the book. The last two pages are their plan to fix renting.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was just so sick of the conversations that. The depressing conversations about crappy flats and, yeah.
They really are an amazing organisation, eh? Like, I just, yeah, like, would you, like, how would you describe them, their organisation? Like, I often think of them as a union, but I guess they're not quite that, are they?
Yeah, well, they're not, because they don't seek to represent people in particular disputes. They're like an advocacy organisation, but where advocacy means advocating through media and to politicians rather than directly representing people, which was kind of similar to the double the quota stuff I was doing. Yeah. I wasn't helping individual refugees and former refugees to find what services they needed. I was working with communities to try and understand, well, to try and increase the number of people given protection. And that's sort of their level. They are, they see the need for this overarching organization that doesn't get too distracted, because you do get distracted. In the refugee space in particular, there are a lot of really tough stories and situations that anyone with a heart would end up becoming like close to one person and their family and spending all their time trying to help those people, which is awesome, but it also takes away from that kind of collective action of trying to bring people together to, not even collective action. It takes away from that sort of higher level policy. An advocacy group, but not a union. I wish I could explain it better. We just did this tour around the country and they got pretty good at explaining what they were to people who didn't know.
Because I think that I must admit that that is extremely powerful. Like that plan that they have is just so, I don't know, and it's really lovely because the way that you all have typeset it, there are ones that have been successfully done, which just feels so great. And I really like the way you've sort of talked about this difference because I think that's what really blew my mind about what you did with the refugee quota is it's one simple message, one simple goal. And, it was incredible. Like it must feel, and I don't know how it feels. How does it feel to see that we're reaching that
this
week?
Oh, it's awesome. Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah. It would be way too navel-gazing to say that it's not. Like it's added so much to my life, the people I've met, the sense of satisfaction. The kind of just the fascinating thing of being involved in the halls of power at Parliament. It is a place where things feel different when you're walking down there. And it is sort of, if I say it's a nexus of power, it doesn't even go towards describing what that sense of power is and the sense of possibility, but also of doom. And there is something in that space that is kind of fascinating to be a part of.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for all that work. It was incredible. You were on tour, and I think that must have been – how is everyone out there, I guess, is what I'm, I'm really interested. Like an event – the events like what you were putting on, I just wonder, like, is it a Wellington-only problem? Does it seem worse in some cities? Are the problems different throughout? I don't know. Did you get a sense of that?
I think the way we were describing it was at that national level, and everyone understands that it is a structural problem that we have not had the imagination or the will from successive governments to address. The people who turned up, there were sort of two types of events. One was the scheduled launch in each city across six or seven different cities. And then there were moments where we would just go onto the University of Otago campus with 500 copies hey there, would you like a novel about renting? It's about a rat who becomes a landlord. There are pictures. No, sorry, not for me, mate. No. Hey, what's it about? Yeah. So those ones you kind of bumped into. I mean, I wouldn't want to generalize from it. There was like a, it's a pretty absurd situation or a weird situation to be standing somewhere trying to give your book away for free and have people treat you like you're giving them some cult which is kind of hilarious. Every writer should do it. You know, mostly
totally
we're just sitting
agree.
Here being like, yeah, you can get it from Unity Books or University Bookshop. But when you're actually there being like, take my book for free, there are pictures, you get a different reading of the world. People are suffering out there, but people find their ways to meddle through. And because we're talking about it at quite a high level about, you know, rats becoming landlords, quite a philosophical thing.
And it's quite a philosophical thing.
People want to talk about it at that level as well.
Which is really interesting as well. Like that kind of symbolic kind of thing does give people space to talk about things in a way that they, at that high level, if you know what I mean. Like, I think, I don't know. I was really interested in some of the conversations I had about the book, and that it does seem to facilitate a different conversation than a story about, you know, a human kind of hideous landlord. But
Although it did, I mean, in other spots, I was sort of thinking of the question and answer sessions. A lot did come back to Renters United. A lot of it was, what can we do? People wanted to be involved in something that was meaningful.
Awesome.
And so, you know, we were signing people up there to to get the emails, to be part of the normal actions to try and get some change, which can be pretty frustrating because they don't have the big abolish landlordism slogan. Yeah. You know, there's no double the quota slogan for Renters United. It's really smart policy work. Not that we didn't have that, but it was less sloganeering and more like, being there.
I really love what you're saying about giving the book away. And I just think, I mean, this gets exceedingly boring because I say it to anyone within the vicinity of Lawrence and Gibson, but this idea of the means of production being in the hands of the writer and the publisher, you know, the physical labour that takes place by a writer to get the book out, and like this direct kind of marketing, sorry, I'm talking marketing terms, but you know what I mean? Like this retail, this direct sales outside sort of the capitalist model just feels like the right sort of zenith of the project. But yeah, I just think it's really interesting because it's a magnificent publication. Like it's gorgeous.
Yeah, and a lot of that came down to Rob Whitaker at Renters, former president of Renters United, who's a designer.
Really?
Yeah, he designed it all, right? So he put it together and, just his time, really. He has a beautiful vision for it. You know, the striking primary colours on the cover.
And were there some limitations around, like, it is, it's not a broadsheet, is it? But it is, like, I mean, the printing, I don't know, like, it's quite an ambitious kind of project in that there's visuals, there's typesetting. So he put that all together himself.
Yeah, put it all together himself.
Oh God, he's mind-blowing.
Yeah, yeah. Like, that was the beauty of working with Renters United. We had a meeting about what we were going to do.
Mm.
We allocated tasks. And then at the next meeting, everyone had done the things they said they were going to do. And they were not easy tasks.
No.
Like, I remember when he came back. So Rob also organised the illustrators. I'd sort of had a list of a few people that I knew who would be good. But he just went away and approached them all. Like, there's a lot of emails in there, a lot of chatting.
Yeah. And was it interesting for you? Like, I guess I don't know if you thought of, like, when I write text, I'm not thinking about illustration. And I just wonder, is it interesting for you to look through it and now see your words interpreted into someone else's art?
It's awesome. Like, it's one of the best things. Like, I really loved when the Helen Clark Young Lover book was made onto the stage.
Oh,
like, it's so validating. Yeah. Not only because you're getting your own work, getting, like, a different new audience, but also because you can stand back and observe it as a somewhat – you're still an interested party, but it's a bit different. It's someone else's interpretation, you're almost more audience than artist. And in this case – I think there was one point, like, a couple of the artists were like, oh, actually, like, can you just actually describe what the flatmates look like? And so when you go through, you see all the flatmates, there's some similarities. It's almost like I was trying to describe someone who for a police lineup. Like, yeah, dark hair, medium-sized nose, Akiha guy, mid to late 20s, bit scruffy. And so there's maybe four or five different versions of them in the book. But maybe the most beautiful thing were all the cute little rats.
Oh.
So adorable and hideous.
See, as I'm terrified of rats, and I still managed to read your book, and then I really do love these rats. I mean, it's the claws that get me every time. But they're really lovely rats. They're really lovely rats.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, you go.
I was just going to say, we found like a really, just you flicking through it there, we found it like a... Because we printed it with, so this wasn't printed at Rebel Press, we couldn't afford I mean, it's printed on the same print run places that the stuff newspapers get printed out in Petone.
Nice.
And so we had their production specs and, you know, there's a whole bunch of things that we were only able to do because 289 people paid money first up to say, yeah, we want this to exist in the world. Yeah, you can send us this reward. And we ended up just getting, over $10,000, which meant we could make 10,000 copies.
Mm-mm.
It was always going to be full colour, which is one of the kind of nice things that, like, you know, me being in my early 40s now, I remember, you know, there's that weird pricing differential between color and black and white ink. And I feel like with some printing, that's just evaporated because it's just ink still. There's not that much that's really changing with it. But some places really hold on to, black and white. Like the printing machine we've got at Lawrence and Gibson, to print in black is maybe like a third of the price of in color. Maybe there's a reason behind it, but I blame capitalism. They charge more for color because they can. And this, we're able to do it in full, glorious color.
Yeah. It's just magnificent. Like, I don't know. I feel so grateful to have, like, I have a copy at home, and then it's been really nice having them up here as well, like just every now and then popping out, and, you know, and people love them. People absolutely love them. Is the whole novel in here?
Yeah, it's the whole novel.
Whoa.
Funny, eh, that it can fit on 40 pages.
Because I've read this twice, you know, like it was just that thing where I was like, is there anything missing? Oh my gosh. And it's not hard to read. Like, I mean, it's not like you've squashed it all into a tiny little thing.
That's Rob, you know, that's Rob's beautiful design.
Genius.
And, you know, he had to lay the text out to create spaces. So it's not just the odd half page has art on it, but he made these specific spaces for the artist to draw within the confines of, which is really cool to think of that as the brief for an artist.
Oh, I see what you mean. Because that's the thing I was thinking, is that everything fits so well. Like, that makes sense. Yeah. Sorry, I'm looking at the rats. This is a audio thing, not a visual thing.
People can get copies from all over the place still, though. I'm going to be overseas from mid-July, but Unity's still got a bunch around. Or if people just want to get one delivered to them out in the middle of nowhere, Renters United have one copies that you can pay. You just pay for the postage there. But there's a whole bunch of places that are free as well.
Awesome. Oh, my gosh, yes, go and get them.
Or you can buy 10 kilos in the North Island from the Lawrence and Gibson website for maybe $25.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, 10 kilos is 70-something copies.
That's an amazing idea.
Yeah, 3 kilos, you can get maybe 20 copies anywhere in the country.
I so 20 like
copies
the
for $15, yeah.
I so like the idea of, buying them by the kilo.
Yeah, it makes us feel like, well, particularly when we had to pick them up, right? We've got 10,000 copies.
Yeah.
It was 4 tons, something like that.
You're kidding.
And so we had to get this City Hop van, but its axle, it could only handle 1 ton on the axle.
Oh my gosh.
So we filled that up with some, and then sort of we were right at the 1 ton, and then and the axle didn't break on the way to Wellington. And then the back of Rob's station wagon, we also
It was like one of those cars that you see on the streets with the low riding. Because that, I guess, your paper is so heavy, eh? Like, I remember realizing that when I was looking at architecture, like sometimes they have to reinforce floors that have got files on them. It's really weird. We started off talking a little bit about travel, and I haven't prepped you for this, so it's totally all right if you don't want to answer it. But you are leaving New Zealand soon.
Yeah.
And do you want to talk a little bit about where you're going, what you're up
to? Yeah, sure. Yeah, this is more in my other sphere of life. I am going to California State University in Los Angeles, and I'm going to be attempting to write a book on New Zealand's sort of emergency responses to humanitarian situations that has led to refugee intakes. So in the last 10 years, the Syrian intake of 2015, the Afghan and Ukrainian ones more recently. So I got a Fulbright scholarship to do that work because Fulbright loves writers at the moment, whoever's
Yay,
in their
Fulbright.
Team. So Rebecca Hawkes, I think, also got one and a couple of other people. It's the best thing possible, right? People give you money to be based in a place and to try and write a book. And this is going to be a nonfiction book, but I'm sort of weaselly got it in my head that I'm going to spend the first month just completely in my own space and try and get the draft of that done. And then maybe I can write some fiction.
We would like that. It is interesting that we started in Albania and you're going to America, because I guess you have to be a bit careful because you're going there. But I guess it's an interesting time to be in the States.
Yeah. I mean, the States is... States is what it is.
Yeah.
And California is a particular state, you know. I'm actually most fascinated with some of those southern states, and not for the political thing or anything. But, I mean, there's the politics is such an easy binary to see, to view that country in. I guess I've been there in different places before, and I feel like it's even washed over on my accent or spending time with Americans in other countries, that I'm just sort of fascinated by the culture of maybe more so even of the southern states. But yeah, Los Angeles, I don't know. I mean, there's going to be an election on there.
Yep.
It's going to be a bunch of high fly. Think of all the New Zealanders living in Los Angeles, and we'll, they'll probably all hate each other or whatever. But maybe there'll be a crew we can get together and have like whoever's got the nicest house. I don't know. Are there any, who's the most famous New Zealander in?
Taika Waititi.
Does he live in LA?
I don't know. I'm making things up
now. Yeah, I'll send him an email then and be like, hey, let's have an election party, bro.
Sounds like a great idea. Is there some, because this is another thing that I think you've done, or I might just be making this up about you, but is there a slight advantage, or is there, you know, like, is it interesting writing about New Zealand while you're overseas, I guess?
I don't know. Like I kind of don't like it in one sense. Like one of the first times I went overseas, and I've often done this, is I'd go to a country. I would have saved a bunch of money here living like a student. And then I would set myself up to have an apartment for 3 or 4 months. Like, you know, as cheap as possible, still renting, definitely nothing flamboyant or flagrant or anything like that. I think it's more just the isolation from here.
Yeah.
I always write about this country as the setting, maybe it's good that you don't get distracted by the everyday, so you don't have that back and forth between watching New Zealand politics. Like I did it in Syria one time, and to get on the internet I had to go to this cool little underground cafe, which I ended up doing a lot more of in the end, but it was sort of every 2 or 3 days I would go online. And so that distance from the immediacy of what this country is might be a good way to summarize it. And I'm just reading Eleanor Catton's latest book at the moment, and she sits it here. And she hasn't lived here for 10 years, and that's really on my mind reading it, thinking, and it's supposed to sort of be contemporary, or maybe a couple of years ago that it's set. And just thinking, that would be so hard to try and write something that contemporary and without actually having lived there for any recent period of time. I don't know, maybe it's not 10 years she's been away, but it is kind of a challenge. You want to still be close enough that you don't get anything wrong. Like I really noticed that one of the parts of the book, she talked about parking meters. I'm like, do we have parking meters that you could tie a bike to anymore? Maybe in some small town. Maybe we used to.
Because I do think that's a really good way of talking about it, like this idea of like not – like breathing the air of it but not being in conversation with it, I think would be really, really useful, especially for a book like you're writing. Like, because I guess what's interesting about a book like that is that eventually it has to have an end date, doesn't it? Like you can't keep adding and adding. You know, that's a different project, you know, I guess. Yeah.
It is a different one, yeah. And there is always new information. I've got my little bookmarks bar. I don't know if you're obsessive with bookmarks.
I've got Pocket. I just like send everything to Pocket. I'm obsessed with it. Yeah.
And then you go back and you're like, or even stuff that might have seemed relevant like 6 months ago anyway, and isn't anymore anyway, yeah. And sometimes the immediate feels more relevant because it's so fresh in your mind.
Oh, yeah, I didn't think of that.
It will be a hard thing to cut off. I feel like there's a bit of a natural ending point for that work.
Yeah.
But I could be wrong.
I can't wait to read it. I really can't wait to read it. I think it's just going to be amazing. Thank you very much. I think we've come to the end. Is there anything else you want to say? Everything.
Always is, yeah. You're such a nice interviewer, Pip.
Aww.
Is there anyone you've just taken to task? I feel like you're the anti-Kim Hill.
Murdoch, tell me about your
this
book.
Ridiculous rat of yours.
What are you thinking of rats? Rah.
What's wrong with property ownership? I own 7 houses.
I wish I did own 7 houses. I just, yeah, sorry.
So you haven't ripped into anyone in an interview?
I don't think
so. It's not really
so.
Your style.
Like, I think the thing is, though, that I think which makes it worse is several people have said they can hear when I'm not impressed.
Oh.
Like, yeah, and that worries me because, like, I don't have a poker face at all. As you know, like I am not good at keeping my opinions to myself with my face. And I think that I do it with my voice as well. But yeah. Ooh. My gosh. What do you think?
That's good. I'd love to learn how to pick Pip Adam.
I can show you the people. Have you got any thoughts about these orcas? Sorry, these orcas that are destroying the boats. I'm a bit obsessed with them, and I thought I do want to ask Murdoch about it.
I do have thoughts on it, but maybe for off air. There's some people I know who are wanting to do some writing in a in a space. Not me, but someone else I know, and I wouldn't want to.
Yeah,
I wouldn't want to like that get into their territory.
Good.
But go with the orcas.
Yeah, go
with
the orcas.
When Animals Attack TV series.
I loved it.
Yes,
I was just. It's really weird for me because I'm sort of revisiting new animals at the moment, and for that I watched over and over again footage of orcas killing their trainers. Like I just spent hours watching orcas killing their trainers, and like, yeah. Now
how
I'm
much
like,
of that is there?
There's more than you would realize. Oh, more
they've
than
suppressed
you'd think.
It, haven't
they've,
they?
They've suppressed the orca killing. I guess they're killer whales when they do that. But yeah. Anyway, thanks heaps, Murdoch.
Thank you.
I hope you have a really nice afternoon.
Yeah, you too.
Thank you.